Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, Russian troops are gathering at the Ukraine border, and we're hearing plenty of revived rhetoric about the new Cold War, which got us thinking about the actual Cold War. With decades of distance, we now have more accurate details and new stories about the politics and ploys and players that kept relations between the U.S. and the Soviets on ice. None more powerful than the threat of mutually assured destruction, a far cry from the promise of the dawn of the atomic age. At that time, Albert Einstein and Marie Curie became heroes to millions around the world. Their discoveries heralded a new era of possibility for humankind. Instead, writes Craig Nelson, that sweet hope has been battered by a history of thermonuclear winter terrors and run-amok power plants. Nelson narrates that sweeping historic arc in vivid detail in The Age of Radiance, the epic rise and dramatic fall of the atomic era. And we welcome Craig Nelson to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Virginia.
Well, you write early in the book, your family is radioactive, your friends are radioactive, your pets. Really? Are we all?
Absolutely. One of the really shocking things I discovered when I first started working on this 5 years ago, if you had asked me what I thought of radioactivity, I would have said poison, cancer, infection, danger, sinister. But I also thought it was very rare and very dangerous. And then I found out it's in microwave ovens and smoke detectors. It's in Brazil nuts and bananas. It's rising up at us from uranium decaying in the bedrock. It's falling down at us from cosmic rays. It's in your pets and in your family and in your friends, and it's in you.
Well, those who had discovered this long before you, many of these names that we've heard or that are in the book, Robert Oppenheimer, Edward Teller, Curtis LeMay, but few have heard the name of a Polish girl named Mania Skłodowska. How do you pronounce it?
Skłodowska. Uh-huh.
Named Mania Skłodowska. Tell us a little bit about the life of this woman who was instrumental to the atomic age.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Mania who was the youngest of a family of five, a family that had once been prosperous but had fallen on hard times. And Mania's older sister, Branya, said, "You know, I have an idea. How about if I go to school and you support me for 2 years, and then I'll turn around and return the favor for you?" And this was an especially wild idea at the time because it was illegal for women to be educated past about the age of 12 where these people lived. And both Mania and her sister Branya got around this by attending something called the Floating University, which floated so the authorities couldn't track down who was running them and throw them into a labor camp. But the Floating University did a great job. Branya got accepted into the Sorbonne, the University of Paris Medical School, and off she went to Paris. And Mania went off to work as a nanny. She's now 17 years old. And she ends up working with a fantastic family called the Zarovskis. And they run a sugar beet plantation about 70 kilometers outside Warsaw. And the children love her. And it's a beautiful, beautiful home where she lives. And then the oldest Zarovsky son, Kazimir, comes home from school. And he and Mania fall head over heels in love. And after a year of romance, he tells her, "We are going to get married. I'm going to tell my parents." The parents say, "No, you're not marrying this penniless little nobody. You're marrying someone of your station or better." And they turn him down. So he and Mania keep seeing each other secretly, and he tells her, "Oh, I'll talk my parents into it. Don't worry. Wait for me." And then they find out about it, the parents, and they fire her. And Mania has to go back to Warsaw and live with her father. And she's just crushed. She's just heartbroken. She's 19. The great love of her life has been taken from her. And then the letter from Branya arrives. "I'm done with school. I'm engaged to be married. And now it's your turn. Come to Paris." But she can't go because she's so in love with Kazimir. And then a letter from him arrives. "It's never going to work out. Forget it. My parents will never say yes." So off she goes to Paris. Decades later, Kazimir would become a famous mathematician, and he would be seen frequently gazing up in the main square of Warsaw at the enormous statue of the national hero of Poland, Marie Curie, which is who Mania grew up to be.
The jilted Mania went on to study in Paris and marry Pierre Curie, who together they were praised for the greatest find in history. That was in 1903. Now, there's a passage in the book where you write about her being just enthralled with the glow of her experiments kept in jars. Since you told told that story so beautifully. I'd love you to paint the picture of Marie Curie tending her little radiated jars.
Well, it's a beautiful image because on the one hand, let's back up just a little bit. Marie and Pierre, one of the great stories in this book is the fact that almost everyone who becomes a great hero of science starts off as nobodies in the middle of nowhere, including the discoverer of the X-ray, Röntgen. And now Marie and Pierre are working in a hut that had previously been used by the community college medical school to teach its students how to dissect cadavers. They get a ton of ore from Bohemia donated, of pitchblende ore. And they find out there's something even more powerful in that ore than uranium. They basically run a chemical composition factory to get whatever is in there out. And they discover radium and polonium, named for Poland. And radium becomes an incredible craze. Many of us remember glow-in-the-dark watches and glow-in-the-dark paint and glow-in-the-dark instruments on planes, all of which were painted with radium. But probably one of the most beautiful images in the book is that Marie would go to her lab first thing in the morning before the sun came up, and she would leave out all of her radium in jars, and she said it was like aquatic fireflies glowing in the light. She just marveled at it. She couldn't stop looking at it. But then some friends did notice that after she put the radium away, the walls were still glowing.
So this beautiful element, which you call in the book the two-faced god, irrational yet powerful, yet destructive, yet so promising. Can you explain what radioactivity is that contains such conflicting capacities for progress and for destruction?
Well, the fundamental issue about radioactivity is that it's these little chubby, morbidly obese atoms. And they're atoms that are so fat that they break the laws of attraction that create our material world and spit out little pieces of themselves. They spit out two kinds of subatomic particles and a stream of energy called gamma ray, which is like a super X-ray. And all of that means, though, that what you have is you have these minerals and metals that are spewing out invisible energy. So in a way, it's sort of like they're alive. And in fact, when you hold a piece of silvery plutonium in your hand, it's warm like a puppy. But then at the same time, at Los Alamos, the medical solution for holding the puppy too long in your hand was called high amputation. So you have this thing that's sort of somewhere between the living and the dead, and I think it's disturbing to many people. I frankly like it, but I think it is disturbing to many people, and that's our fundamental fear of radioactivity. How can something that seems to be alive come out of matter? And that's why we call the dissolution of radiation over time a half-life. It's not a life, it's a half-life.
We're speaking with Craig Nelson about the age of radiance, the atomic age that began in the late 19th century and really dominated the 20th century. Craig Nelson says it is now in its twilight. The development of nuclear physics from that point with Marie Curie and then carried on by Fermi and Szilard, is that how I say his name?
Leo, yes, you can say Szilard or Szilard. Almost everyone in this book wanted to become American, so we can pronounce them with as American accent as we want.
Well, this development of nuclear physics and energy running in parallel with geopolitics of the time. So what kind of political forces were shaping the development back in those very early days when Enrico Fermi and Leo Szilard built the first nuclear reactor, by the way, speaking of the cadaver hut, in a squash court.
Exactly.
Court at the University of Chicago.
Exactly. So the astonishing thing about all of this that I discovered was that in 1941, when fission is discovered, everyone in America hears the idea of splitting the nucleus of an atom as a source of bombs and power and thinks it's crackerjacks. The American physicists are all working on radar. And when they start hearing these nuclear physicists start talking about this idea, they think they're out of their minds. But the nuclear physicists who are working on it are all refugees from Europe. And they are consumed with one idea: what if Hitler got an atomic bomb? And this literally drives the entire Manhattan Project from start to finish. What if Hitler had an atomic bomb? So one of the things that I thought was very interesting in researching this book is that I think the generally educated public, when they hear the story of Los Alamos, basically it's told to us that, you know, Einstein and Oppenheimer wrote some equations on a board and then voila, bombed. Mm-hmm. But in fact, a number of the most dangerous experiments in the history of American science took place to make those bombs. And the first one was the first nuclear reactor. There was a strike at the building that the first nuclear reactor was supposed to be in, the Argonne Forest outside Chicago. So the University of Chicago said, well, we have this abandoned football stadium since we've given up football, and inside there's this squash court we aren't using. What about that? And they said, okay, let's do this. So what I think is just terrifying is that the very first nuclear reactor to ever work ever was built in the middle of the city of Chicago, where you can imagine many terrible things happening. But the guy who did it, Enrico Fermi, was so meticulous and such a good researcher that it went off without an error. But there is a very funny postscript to this story. The Soviet spies who were sending information back to Moscow, there is a mix-up in translation. So for almost 40 years, the Soviets thought the first nuclear reactor was born not in a squash court, but in a pumpkin patch.
Well, these are just the wonderful details that you bring to life in this book, and there are so many personalities and so many stories and glimpses into human frailties. But one of the things I see here that's part of what you write about is this beauty of discovery, this kind of vivid possibility of discovery. And now you're seeing the nuclear era in its twilight. Did it get ruined along the way by all of the destruction at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, Fukushima?
Absolutely. I like to say that Americans first learned about nuclear science when they saw pictures of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that's been associated with everything nuclear ever since. And then we learned about nuclear power from a funny coincidence, which is that when the meltdown happened in Three Mile Island, the Jane Fonda movie China Syndrome was playing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So our entire image of nuclear science and nuclear power stems from these horrors, and that's the immediate reaction we have to everything is tinged by those two ideas. What I think the reason why I think we're in the twilight years of nuclear power is that every single time there's an accident, could the authorities and both the industry and government do a worse job? I mean, really, they really could not do a worse job.
Well,
than
your
do.
Account of Fukushima just shows that. I mean, I think there are many Americans that have the impression that there are Homer Simpsons running our nuclear power plants.
They are right. There are Homer Simpsons
power. So the point, of course, is it's not the power itself. It's the people who are running it and regulating it and making a lot of money off of it in some cases.
And how they react to these accidents, you know, to have immediately the government and industry in charge of a nuclear accident clamp down and be less than transparent and be less than forthcoming and withhold data and mislead people. It happens again and again and again. The great irony about Three Mile Island is that the safety features of American nuclear reactors worked in that instance. No one was ever harmed because of Three Mile Island. But everyone in America thinks it was this horrible tragedy, a big disaster. So the government and the industry in that case blew that too.
Well, it is hard to reckon, Craig Nelson. You write devastating descriptions of the human and environmental costs at Chernobyl and at Fukushima. And then you argue that nuclear power is the most environmentally viable option for energy. I'm just trying to reckon those two, and it sounds like you've struggled with that yourself.
Well, it is a struggle because, you know, first of all, we just have reports that air pollution is entering California from China. So their use of coal has gotten so over the top that their air pollution is now being exported back to the west coast of the United States. So while everyone is asking me as I do these interviews, what about the pollution from Fukushima? I say, well, you need to start worrying more about coal. 16,000 Americans die every year from the pollution caused by using coal to produce electricity. And petroleum is not much better, even if you don't care about greenhouse gases in the future. And then, you know, natural gas would be great if it wasn't for fracking. So to say that we should have no nuclear ever because of these three accidents, when you compare it to these other things, it's not so terrible.
Are you sad to lose the atomic age? I mean, there is a part of me that senses a kind of nostalgia and wonder about it.
The terrible sadness is the fact that a great number of tests were done at Nevada and in the Pacific with all these various bombs. That data could have been helpful to come up with better nuclear technology that people considered to be safe and that was economically viable. But instead, all of that data is classified. So the United States has totally contaminated the state of Nevada. And in fact, those Nevada test site bombs have totally contaminated the continental United States, with 11,000 Americans dying from that pollution every year. But we aren't able to use that data for anything good because it's still classified even though it's 60 years old. So that to me is tragic.
Craig Nelson's new book is called The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. What a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia. It's been great.
You'll find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The history books and plenty of contemporary pundits call it the Cold War, but in the eyes of the U.S. government, our nearly 50-year standoff with the Soviet Union was not an actual war. That means that the American soldiers who flew spy planes or manned nuclear submarines during the Cold War aren't technically veterans.
Bill Robinson was part of an elite crew, people who had their finger on the button.
I spent a better part of 5 years in SAC, the Strategic Air Command, flying B-52s.
Circling the Arctic for 24 hours at a time.
And I also flew them in Vietnam.
If given the order, he would have nuked Moscow.
We had one purpose and only one purpose, and that was to put our bombs on the target regardless of battle damage, regardless of anything other than complete destruction of the airplane. So we all knew that we were basically flying a suicide mission.
Well, officially they were called Chrome Dome missions. They were tested constantly, rehearsing World War III over and over again.
Every time we had a practice alert, we never actually knew whether it was for real or not. But if it were the real thing, of course, we would have nothing to come back to. In the back of our minds and my mind, I knew that my family would probably be vaporized.
Bill and his crewmates were on the front lines of the Cold War. But when the Soviet Union fell, there were no victory parades, no medal ceremonies. Gorbachev was barely clinging to power. And the first President Bush was worried that if it looked like America was gloating, there might be a backlash in the Soviet Union. Now, Bill Robinson understands that, but he still felt unappreciated.
It would be nice to have somebody say thank you. You know, it would have been nice to have somebody say, well, as my old ops officer said, it was a real bucket of snot, but thanks.
Bill is part of a growing movement of retired servicemen who are supporting the American Cold War Veterans Association. The organization is lobbying Congress to create a Cold War Service Medal. They have the support of 7 senators, but the Pentagon is against it. Here's the problem. The Department of Defense does not consider the Cold War a real war, and they're worried that if they give medals to people who didn't serve in combat, they'll water down the whole meaning of the word veteran.
I'm Scott Lecuyer.
Scott Lecuyer believes that he was in a real war,
and
the contribution of his crewmates needs to be recognized.
Sometimes I wonder if President Reagan was still around and conscious of this, would he have recognized us? And I've spoken to Ronald Reagan, actually, on a Christmas day when I was out in a missile site once. He called us and said, Merry Christmas.
Scott spent 4 years as a chief mechanic at a nuclear missile silo. The job was grueling. The missiles were constantly malfunctioning, but the base had to be fully operational in case the Soviets took a first strike. The crew was tested every day, not knowing if it was the real thing. One of Scott's roommates couldn't handle the stress. He was kicked out.
I can't tell you how much that guy did for the mission. He couldn't do the job, but he propped us up so much so he might as well have been the truck that drove us there. And when they kicked him out, it was unbelievable to all of us because, you know, he was like our parent. We didn't realize he couldn't go home because of the family issues, and he hung himself in our room. I have a flag that's on my mantle right now that was flying over the squadron at the time, and I keep it in a box in his memory.
Those memories weigh heavily on Scott. he had trouble adjusting to the outside world. And he describes his experience as being like underground solitary confinement. Scott was eventually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He showed up at a local VA hospital, and that's when he discovered he wasn't technically a veteran because he didn't serve during an official period of war like Vietnam.
I was locked out from being a new applicant because of my service dates weren't during a war period. And I went crazy. And that's when I really got involved.
Scott now recruits members for the American Cold War Veterans Association. He's hoping to change the system, which he thinks is unfair.
Everybody's made hay on the Cold War, from authors to politicians to the media. Everybody for 50 years has made their careers on the Cold War. And it was us that carried out that mission. And the fact that we're forgotten is unbelievable.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have pledged their support, but getting money's going to be tough. A new generation of soldiers is coming home with pressing concerns. The Cold War veterans might have to hunker down for a long fight. The payoff may be years down the road, but they're used to that.
Producer Eric Malinsky there. Coming up, another group that has gone largely unrecognized by history, the women of the Manhattan Project. That story after the news.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The story of the development and deployment of the atomic bomb is generally dominated by figures like Oppenheimer, Truman, and Stimson, operating at the highest levels of government. What few people know, however, is how many women played a crucial, albeit unknowing, role in one of the most significant turning points in the 20th century and in history. Denise Kiernan interviewed several women who worked in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, a secret government-built town created as part of the Manhattan Project. Their stories, combined with detailed reporting, come together in her book, The Girls of Atomic City. I spoke with Denise when the book first came out and asked her about the town of Oak Ridge itself, which did not appear on any maps, and wondered what brought the women to work there.
The town of Oak Ridge was actually purpose-built. Some people think it was repurposed for the war, but actually it did not exist before late 1942 when they broke ground and did not appear on any maps until 1949. The government went in, and really between late 1942 and mid-1945 took what was really a very unpopulated, not exclusively unpopulated, but, you know, a very sparsely populated area in East Tennessee, and turned it into a town of 75,000 residents using more electricity than New York City, operating one of the country's largest bus systems. And many of those residents were, in fact, young women.
They came from all over the U.S., some from right there, like Toni Peters, one of the women you spoke to. Her family's farm was seized to make way for the town. Others got on buses in New York City and Texas and Alabama to come there, many leaving home for the first time. Denise, what kind of jobs were they doing?
That varied widely, much as it did throughout the war. As we know, World War II was a moment of increased opportunity in the workplace for women across the United States. For the Manhattan Project, because Oak Ridge was itself a functioning town, there were jobs such as, you know, there were secretarial jobs, there were jobs in the cafeteria, and there were jobs, of course, in the plants that were working to enrich uranium for the bomb. Some people, like Colleen, one of the women I feature, she inspected pipes all day. Now, she didn't know where these pipes were going, and she didn't know what was going to be going through them or what purpose they served, but she was trained very specifically to inspect pipes. Toni, the young lady you mentioned earlier, she worked as a secretary. She worked filing all day. And even though she was actually in the headquarters building, she still did not have any idea what the project was about. Other women, scientists, might have analyzed compounds in a lab. Other women worked operating machines that were actually helping separate isotopes of uranium, but of course they did not know that. So the jobs available to them really did vary greatly, some of them Manhattan Project specific, and others just the kinds of jobs you would find in any town.
Without any information about what they were actually doing, rumors swirled. And there were a couple that you write about, you know, one that people who were hired to empty the garbage were illiterate.
Sure.
And there were public information officers deliberately fueling some of them. Now, this was a town of 75,000 surrounded by fencing and watchtowers and guards. I mean, how did this affect them? How did they talk about that experience of living in a place that sort of looks like prison?
Well, what was interesting is I think one of the things that made it, I mean, certainly it was unnerving on a certain level, but then what most of the women said and the men I interviewed is you just started getting used to it. It was, you know, you went through the gate and wore a badge to get where you needed to go. And, you know, at first when you arrived, that was a little shocking and unnerving. But then after a while, it was just kind of normal. A lot of what got them through, I will say, is that the one thing they were not told a lot, but the one thing that they were told was that this was an important project for the war. And pretty much everybody I interviewed had a brother or, you know, a boyfriend or somebody who was away fighting. And so at this, in this period of time, I mean, it really was, World War II really was the cause of their generation. And I think they were willing, most of them, to put up with the secrecy, and, you know, for that very reason.
We're talking with the writer Denise Kiernan about the thousands of women who worked entirely unwittingly on the Manhattan Project in a secret government-built town in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's a subject of her book, The Girls of Atomic City. Now, Denise, this is an era of overt sexism and racism in American culture and social mm-hmm. structures. Many of these women were given a kind of independence in this experience. You spoke to one, Katie Strickland. She's an African-American who did janitorial services at CEW. That's the Clinton Engineering Works. What was her experience compared to other women?
Well, because there was racism was and segregation was the law of the Oak Ridge Reservation, which was also called the Clinton Engineer Works. For Katie, it was, I felt so privileged to be able to speak with her because, you know, she was sharing a part of her life that in many ways was very difficult and stressful for her. However, the pay that she received was what encouraged her to go ahead and live under these circumstances as, you know, as upsetting and angering and frustrating as they were. And I think the most heartbreaking aspect of her existence was the fact that African-American couples married were not allowed to live together, mm-hmm. and they were not allowed to bring their children. So Katie and her husband, Willie, had to leave their children with Katie's mother back in Alabama, and they would send as much money as they could back home whenever it was possible. And it was a very, very trying time for that reason. But at the same time, Katie still lives there today. I mm-hmm. saw her, you know, just a couple weeks ago. So, you know, oddly enough, that place became home to her.
Many, many of the couples did. You keep this secret, referring to the project throughout the book until 1945, when the Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson, sends a letter to all of those working in Oak Ridge on August 7th, congratulating them on their patriotic duty. The headline in the Oak Ridge Journal after the two bombs were dropped says, "Oak Ridge attacks the Japanese." It's so interesting. They all took this on very sort of personally, but how did they feel? Tens of thousands of people were killed. They were working in secret on something that a lot of people had great ethical qualms about.
It was it's a fascinating part of the book for me. It was fascinating to research and do that particular line of interviewing because for so many people, the realization of what the bomb was came sort of in waves. I mean, I don't know what it's like to live in a world without the atomic bomb. I don't know what it's like to live in a world without the idea of fallout shelters and nuclear winter and somebody who can push a button and, you know, unleash something so incredibly devastating and destructive. These people straddled two worlds, really, mm-hmm. And they were around for the dawn of the nuclear age and were a very significant part of it. For some people, the first thing they heard was just, there's a new super bomb. And okay, there's a new super bomb. Then there's the address from the president, and Oak Ridge is mentioned.
Right.
So they know they had something to do with the new super bomb, but specifically, no one was taken aside and said, here's the role that you did. And there was a real mix of feelings. I mean, one woman I spoke to, I think, really kind of captured it best. She said, you know, I was so, because around them, the entire country, of course, is thrilled the war is over.
Right.
And this one woman said, you know, I was so happy the war was over, but I was so sad when I learned about what happened because, you know, I really like people. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very, very simple and kind of very poignant way to put it. So there were a lot of mixed feelings. No one I talked to was happy about the devastation. Some people, you know, felt very sad. And some people were just happy that their brothers or boyfriends or fathers were coming home.
Denise Kiernan there, author of The Girls of Atomic City. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tensions in eastern Ukraine this week appear to be following the script which played out last month in Crimea. Here in the U.S., talk of the new Cold War follows another familiar narrative, the free and democratic U.S. against the Russian despots. While we are nowhere near the Cold War threats of mutually assured destruction, Russian President Vladimir Putin has made it clear that he's nostalgic for the geopolitical muscle Russia had in the Soviet era. It appears he'd like to flex some other muscles as well. Last month, Putin signed an executive order to revive the Stalin-era fitness program called Ready for Labor and Defense. We wanted to know what was in that program that was designed in the 1930s. And our guest is Robert Edelman, professor of Russian history and the history of sport at the University of California, San Diego. Robert Edelman, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So bring us back to 1930s Russia. What was going on in the country at the time, and what led to the introduction of this national fitness program?
Basically, the Soviet Union is, in the 1930s, is the industrialization process. You have literally millions upon millions of rural dwellers showing up in the cities, given invitations to work in factories, and many of them did perfectly willingly. But one thing they didn't do very well was perform efficiently because they were in dreadful physical condition. And so the response to this was to create this badge, which is, again, «Готов к труду и обороне», which means ready for labor and defense. Mm-hmm. So the idea of sports was to become modern. Sports were a modern activity, and also it had this functional basis or benefit of making better workers or fitter workers and better soldiers.
Well, what did that look like? So, you know, was this before they started on the factory floor every morning having to do exercises?
Absolutely. Factory exercises were very much part of the sports scene there, if you want to call it sport. You would read in the National Sports Daily, Krasny Sport, Red Sport, directions about how to organize your exercises, your factory exercises, and instructions on how to actually perform them. There was also a radio show broadcast each morning leading people in exercises for when they woke up. I don't think grenade throwing was necessarily part of it.
Somehow I'm seeing medicine balls and flag hoisting.
You know, various events, running, jumping, swimming, probably a bit of weightlifting. Nothing hugely unusual or sinister.
So if Stalin's program had participants run and swim and ski and climb rope and do pull-ups and that kind of thing, what do you expect President Putin's fitness program to look like?
Well, I'd quarrel with one thing. I don't really think this was Stalin's idea at all. I mean, I think it's something he went along with because he could be convinced that it was a good thing, but he never cared at all about sport. He had no interest in it whatsoever. But, you know, there's a thing that, if we want to get Cold War, we can say Karl Marx referred to history first time as tragedy and then the second time as farce. There is a health crisis in Russia now, and especially for males, the average life expectancy is 64 years, which gets down into third world country or whatever term we're using now, developing or emerging markets. How it will be sold, how it will be organized, if this is just something to be window dressing, and of course the Soviets and Russians and other parts of their history were very good at window dressing. So I would argue that, first of all, in the Soviet period, the sports machine, the elite sports machine, was hiding Soviet weaknesses. And I think this is perhaps a sincere attempt to deal with what are some problems that are very real in Russia today. And then, of course, the other aspect of this is Putin as sportsman running around, you know, riding horses and things like that with his shirt off. And, you know, the only person that comes to mind among world leaders in the 20th century or 21st who did that, of course, was Benito Mussolini. Mm. And that's, you know, that's a form of governmental organization, which is obviously very different from what existed in the Soviet Union and maybe tells us more about what is existing in Russia now. I mean, this is nothing, not a Cold War that's ideologically freighted. They're not trying to force us to become Russian or whatever that might mean. These are geopolitical struggles, clashes that can, in fact, perhaps be negotiated.
Robert Edelman, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Robert Edelman, professor of Russian history and the history of sport at UC San Diego. For more information on the Soviet era program and the revival thereof, go to wordofmouthradio.org. The Russians established the Ready for Labor and Defense program back in the 1930s. By the 1960s, here in the U.S., President John Kennedy was working on an ambitious campaign to combat the declining health of Americans. To help raise awareness for his campaign, JFK recruited not a bird, not a plane, but the one and only Superman to get Americans excited about fitness. The comic book titled Superman's Mission for President Kennedy is now on view at the JFK Library in Boston. WBUR's Andrea Shea has the story.
I think in recent years we have seen many evidences in the most advanced tests, comparative tests that have been made, that many of the boys and girls who live in other countries have moved ahead of younger people in this country in their ability to endure a long physical hardship, in their physical fitness, and in their strength.
Those findings clearly touched a nerve in President Kennedy, according to JFK Library and Museum Director Tom Putnam. He says the new president was serious about this nation's fitness.
President Kennedy, after he was elected, actually wrote an article in Sports Illustrated called The Soft American in December of 1960. He was a youthful, vigorous president, and he cared about the vigor, he said, vigor of America.
President Eisenhower had created a fitness council, but Putnam says the far more buff Kennedy really stepped up the game. JFK developed a national exercise program for schools and pushed young Americans to do their calisthenics, along with this Robert Preston song.
Touchdown, every morning, 10 times, not just now and then. Give that chicken fat back to the chicken, and don't be chicken again. No, don't be chicken again.
But Putnam says JFK pulled out the big guns by teaming with Superman to get his message out. White House Press Secretary Pierre Salinger worked with DC Comics writers and artist Al Plastino to draft Superman's Mission for President Kennedy. The plot kicks off with an avalanche in Switzerland. Superman arrives to save a group of European and American teens, but the Americans are, well, wimps. In the Oval Office, the disheartened president watches the news on TV, then calls Superman to the White House.
John F. Kennedy says, "We must show our youngsters that everyone has to keep fit." And Superman says, "I agree, Mr. President, and I'll do all I can to help close this muscle gap."
That's a clever reference to the missile gap between the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the time.
So it really fit President Kennedy's notion of a new frontier and kind of how to get the country moving again.
Superman issue number 168 was in production when President Kennedy was assassinated. DC Comics pulled the JFK story off the press, but as Putnam reads from issue 170's first page, President Lyndon Johnson later requested it to be published as a tribute to his predecessor.
So we dedicate to the memory of our late beloved president this plea for his physical fitness program, to which he was wholeheartedly devoted during his life.
And our thanks to Andrea Shea for that story. One of the great joys for me as host of Word of Mouth is getting out of the studio to moderate and MC community events. One of my absolute favorites is the annual Poetry Out Loud State Finals in Concord, where high school students from around the state bring their favorite poems to life in front of a live audience. And now that it's April, National Poetry Month, we decided to bring the taste of the event directly to you.
My name is Eden Suoth. I'm a senior at Spalding High School, and the title of my poem is Vigil Strange, I Kept on the Field One Night by Walt Whitman. Vigil strange I kept on the field one night, when you, my son, and my comrade dropped at my side that day. One look I but gave, which your dear eyes returned, with a look I shall never forget. One touch of your hand to mine, O boy, reached up as you lay on the ground. Then onward I sped in the battle, the even, contested battle. Till late in the night, relieved to the place at last again, I made my way. Found you in death so cold, dear comrade, found your body, son of responding kisses, never again on earth responding. Bared your face in the starlight, curious the scene, cool blew the moderate night wind. Long there and then in vigil I stood, dimly around me the battlefield spreading. Vigil wondrous and vigil sweet, there in the fragrant, silent night. But not a tear fell, not even a long drawn sigh. Long, long I gazed, then on the earth, partially reclining, sat by your side, leaning my chin in my hands, passing sweet hours, immortal and mystic hours with you, dearest comrade. Not a tear, not a word. Vigil of silence, love, and death, vigil for you, my son and my soldier. As onward silently stars aloft, eastward new ones upward stole. Vigil final for you, brave boy. I could not save you, swift was your death, I faithfully loved you and cared for you living. I think we shall surely meet again, till at latest lingering of the night, indeed just as the dawn appeared. My comrade I wrapped in his blanket, enveloped well his form, folded the blanket well, tucking it carefully overhead and carefully under feet. And there and then, and bathed by the rising sun, my son in his grave, in his rude dug grave I deposited, ending my vigil strange with that. Vigil of night and battlefield dim, vigil for boy of responding kisses, never again on earth responding, vigil for comrade swiftly slain, vigil I never forget. How as day brightened, I rose from the chill ground and folded my soldier well in his blanket and buried him where he fell.
You'll find a link to watch the competition online, along with more on how your school can be involved with Poetry Out Loud at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, we understand that poetry can be a little intimidating for the uninitiated, and that's why we're celebrating National Poetry Month with a very low-stakes challenge, asking listeners to create and send in their own original haikus about public radio. So in case you need just a bit of inspiration, here are a few early submissions to get you started. Wait, wait, don't tell me. Carl Castle retiring? Say it ain't so, Pete. Out of place accent. cuts through interstate traffic. Beardsley in Paris. We invite you to share your own public radio haiku on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. And don't forget to use the hashtag #RadioHaiku. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.